So the great theologian, Kenny Chesney, has this great song about an old blue rocking chair. The song really is just about how he sees life differently or how he views circumstances differently when he just stops and watches the world from afar, from the comfort of his little rocking chair. Now, I'm blessed. I don't have a long list of complaints by any means, but one thing that I really miss having is a front porch where I can just put a chair out and watch the world go by, you know, just sit out and watch as things happen. So I get to the point of seeing things a little differently from, I understand Kenny Chesney's point about just seeing things a little differently when you're relaxed and sitting in the comfort of your chair. I have tried to do what I suggested last week that we all try to do, and that is to try and view nature in a way that allows you to see the omnipotence or the power of God. I don't have a front porch, but I do have a backyard. And on certain dark nights, it's fantastic just to go out there and see the stars when they're bright, see the moon, to see the harvest moon, to see certain planets when they're in sight for us to see. But what if I told you that this all-powerful God that we learned about last week is also all-knowing? The fancy word for that is omniscient. He's an omniscient, all-knowing, still all-powerful God. Listen to the way he's described by David in Psalm 139, the first five verses. O Lord, you have examined my heart and know everything about me. You know when I sit down or stand up. You know my thoughts even when I'm far away. You see me when I travel and when I rest at home. You know everything I do. You know what I'm going to say even before I say it, Lord. You go before me and you follow me. I guess what I want to do today is just ask one simple question. Is that good news or bad news? I mean, like, seriously, let's not candy coat this. Like, the Almighty knows you completely, intimately, thoroughly. He sees and knows every temptation of your heart. He knows every thought you've ever had or ever will have. It's crystal clear to him. It's HD. He knows every place you've gone and every place you're going to go. He knows every friend you've had and every friend you're going to have. It's all been fully known to him. Everything you've done in life, he knows. Every word you've whispered, he's heard. He's all-knowing, and he's all-powerful. And for some, that could be a really frightening thought, right? I mean, it might be a frightening reality for some of us to face. Our deepest fears in this fallen world often reflect our deepest needs. And because of that, one of our deepest needs is to be known. Yet we're terrified of it. There's an author by the name of Donald Miller. About 10 years ago, he was writing a book called Scary Close. At that point in his life when he was writing this book, he had become relatively famous in the world because of another book he had written called Blue Light Jazz. And so he was known as an author, known as a speaker, and while he's writing Scary Close, he was also entering into a brand new territory in his life. He was about to get married. In other words, he was going to be known at a level and in a way that he'd never been known by anyone else in his life up until this point. And this is what he had to say about himself in his book. I don't trust people who accept who I am in the process. I'm the kind of person who wants to present my most honest, authentic self to the world. So I hide backstage and rehearse honest and authentic lines until the curtain opens. It's a pretty creative way of avoiding being open. David reflects it this way in verses 7 to 12. I can never escape from your spirit. I can never get away from your presence. If I go up to the heaven, you're there. If I go down to the grave, you're there. If I ride on the wings of the morning, if I dwell on the farthest ocean, even there your hand will guide me and your strength will support me. I could ask the darkness to hide me and the light around me to become night, but even in the darkness I cannot hide from you. To you the night shines as bright as day. Darkness and light are the same to you. In other words, there's nowhere we can go to run. There's nowhere we can go to hide from the most all-powerful and all-knowing God of the universe. You just can't do it. But it doesn't stop us from trying, does it? Which brings me back to the chair. Jesus told a story one time about a brief discussion that happened between a father and a son. And I've always imagined that it might be happening between the father and the son while they were on the front porch of their home. Maybe dad was sitting in his chair. But the son came to him. Here's what he said. I want my share of the estate now before you die. Almost and kind of, in other words, if you think it through, I wish you were dead. But since you're not, can I go ahead and get your money anyway? We can speculate about what would cause such an emotional or relational break between these two, but at the end of the day, they had come to the place where the son no longer trusts the father's intentions toward him. He assumes his dad's holding out on him. He thinks there's something better for him out there in the world than what his dad is offering him right here at home right now. So he needs, what he needs is some resources to fund his next endeavor. So he's asking his father, and it's really culturally important for us to understand this. He's saying, Dad, what I want you to do is tear down everything you've spent your life building up so that I can have what I want. And in mind-blowing, unexpected fashion, the father does it. The heart of the father is probably broken as he hands the funds over to his son. But he decided he's not going to force the son to stay home if that's not where he wants to be. So sometime down the road, maybe a few days, weeks, even a couple months, the son packs up all his belongings and he moves to a distant land. And I just imagine the father sitting there in his chair, watching as his son walks off into the sunset. I imagine tears streaming down his face, his heart just beating. And I imagine the father sitting there knowing full well what kind of trouble his son's about to find himself getting into, his pockets full of money and his heart full of rebellion. Because he's not naive. Fathers are fully aware of the temptation their children face. They're fully aware of what a person can do when he has his heart set on rebellion. And sure enough, the son arrives in the distant land. He thinks he has no responsibility and no accountability, and so he consequently just goes on doing whatever it is he wanted to do. He actually called it freedom, because he doesn't think there's anything in life to restrain him anymore. He doesn't have to worry about what his father thinks. He doesn't have to worry about the family's reputation. He doesn't have to worry about what his brother's going to say about him. He just does whatever he wants to do. He's in the land of opportunity. The world is his oyster. Luke 15:13, and there he wasted all of his money on wild living. It would be easy for us today enough to fill in the blanks about what wild living meant, but the bottom line is he lived out of control. He spent everything he had trying to find something that he was in search of. We don't know how long it took, but we know he ran out of money. The party stopped, the buzz wore off, the women went home, the friends didn't show up any longer, and then, if that's not bad enough, things got worse. About this time, his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land, and he began to starve. So not only does his money run out, which was the thing that he had put his trust in, but this land of opportunity has now turned into a wasteland. The place that he thought was going to provide him everything he ever wanted and all of this freedom now provides him with nothing but pain. And yet, for a bit, he still thinks he's in control. He thinks he can manage his own life. He thinks he can do it on his own. And so he uses his power of persuasion, and he uses his power of persuasion to lock down a job. Even in a really bad economy, he was able to find a job. Verse 15, he persuaded a local farmer to hire him, and the man sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. So here's the question. This young man's got a job. It's not a glamorous job. It's a pretty dirty job. He's feeding pigs. And in the context of a famine, what do you think he'd be feeding the pigs? I mean, you have nothing to eat for yourself, but he's got this bucket of something that he's feeding the pigs, and you can bet that something wasn't very good, right? So here's this young man. He's feeding these pigs, and he's feeding them. As he's feeding them, the story goes like this. The young man became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him, but no one gave him anything. I don't have pigs at my house. And I started thinking about this. I don't know anyone who raises them. I know a few people who raise chickens. Even when it comes to chickens, I don't know a lot about them, but after being around them for a few minutes at some friends' homes, I've learned this. Chickens are pretty gross. Chickens will eat anything up to and including chicken, which is kind of disturbing. But I've seen kids who have raised chickens, and they go out to feed them. And the one thing the kids never, ever do when they go out and feed the chickens is dine with them. Because chickens are gross. You want to know what's more gross than chicken? Pigs. And so here's this young man, and he's hungry, and he's desperate, and he's finding himself wanting to eat this stuff that he's feeding the pigs. And it begs the question, what would lead him to such desperation? And it's in the moment of this desperation when he kind of remembers another reality. No one showed up for him. No one is losing moments' sleep at his demise. He has no friends. If it's true in life that you are at your worst moment, you will find out who your friends really are, then this man has no friends. But he did remember that he has a father. He still has a father, and not only in this moment does he remember his father, but he also remembers the father's table. And he remembers who was welcomed at that table. It wasn't just the family, the servants were welcome there too. When he finally came to his senses, Scripture says, he said to himself, "At home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare, and here I am dying of hunger. I will go home and say to my father, 'Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Please take me on as a hired servant.'" So when he comes to his senses, he remembers the reality of his father's home. And at his father's house, at his father's table, you don't even have to be a son to eat well. You can be a slave. So he begins to rehearse the speech that he hopes will pull on the father's heartstrings just enough that the father will allow him back on the property and back at the table, even if as a servant. He knows the space between the feed buckets and the father's table is occupied by his father. And he knows he's going to have to face his father. But the last time he saw him, his dad was probably sitting in a chair with tears streaming down his face because of the pain he had caused him. So with a rehearsed speech on his lips and hunger in his belly, he heads home. Here are his key words. He returned home to the father. Got a few Greek words that I really appreciate. One of my favorite is the Greek word gnostis. It's where we get our word nostalgia from. It simply means a longing for home. In Greek mythological context, it's the archetypical hero's journey that you might have heard about before. It's where the young man leaves his home, leaves his family, leaves his parents, and he goes off to a far place. He leaves behind all of the provision and all the protection of his home, and he goes out to fight great battles, maybe even to be a dragon slayer. And if he's successful, he gets the gold and he gets the girl, and he comes home, he's back to his community with these accumulated things, with all of his accumulated knowledge and wisdom, most important, victory. He comes home, he's celebrated as a hero. But for the prodigal, this was not a hero's journey. Because the son comes home with nothing. He's not won any battles, he's not slain any dragons. He's not accumulated any gold. He's lost all the gold. He's been defeated. He's empty-handed. He's ashamed. He's lost big. He blew it. And many of us know exactly what it feels like to fail the father, right? It's not always in the big stories of massive rebellion. It's not always in the dramatic where we run off and lose everything, blow it, come home battered and broken. Sometimes it's just in the small moments. But you become so full of shame because you did it again. That sin that's just tested you over and over, you did it again. That thing that brought you a momentary high now doesn't satisfy at all, just brings guilt and shame. And in those moments where you lose temper and you take God's name in vain for the 100th time, or you say that awful thing that you wish you could just take away, and you're just embarrassed because you're not a more even-tempered person. In those days when you swear you'll never send another text message like that again. In those days when you say, I'll never talk like that again. Deep down you feel like you're a slave to your sin. But on top of that, sometimes it's not even sin that leads to this place of feeling like a failure. Sometimes we just look at where we are in life and we're like, I'm failing. We ask, what would have happened if I just would have worked a little harder? What would have happened if I would have taken that opportunity? What would have happened if I wouldn't have made that dumb choice? And I think the boy in this story must have felt like the biggest failure in the world at that moment. He thought at one time he knew best. There was a time in life when he was so full of arrogance. He knew in his mind that he could make a better life for himself than the one his father had made for him. And he messed it all up in an epic way. He left with his pockets full of money and he's coming home with his pockets empty. How shameful. And now he's got to face the father. How scary. And the smart money, by the way, if you're a betting man, would be placed on the father probably chasing his son off and saying, nope, you're not coming back now. And some of the money, if you're a betting person, might land on, well, father just might take him in, but he's going to really lay into this kid first. But the kid's got his speech. He's hoping it might just be enough to compel his father to allow him to live like a slave in the place he used to call home. And while he was a long way off, his father saw him coming. The father's sitting in his chair. He's on this front porch where he's been for a whole lot of days in a row just scanning the horizon. And you get the sense from the story that it had been many days in a row that the father just kept going out there looking and looking and looking and hoping ever since the son left that one day he might see him coming back. You know, one of the things I've learned about as being a parent is I can sometimes recognize my kids from a long way off. You don't always have to know the number on the back of the jersey. You can sometimes tell by the way they walk. You just know that's the person in the distance that you know. There's no question about it. The father saw that boy in the distance, and he's like, he's coming home. Here's the question. Now, what are the father's intentions for the son? The whole story is going to hinge on that question and how it plays out. Luke 15:20. Filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son and embraced him and kissed him. Can you picture it? The father seeing this unmistakable silhouette of his son on the horizon. He knows him so well, he gets up from his chair, and as undignified as it would have been for an older man, he starts running in that moment. He runs toward his son full of love and full of compassion, and he goes to the son while the son was a long way off, Scripture says. But the son, from his perspective, still might be terrified. He sees his father running toward him, but he doesn't know why he's running toward him. He doesn't know if he's filled with anger or filled with love or filled with compassion. The son doesn't know at this point. He probably flinched as his father put his arms around him. And then he starts his speech. Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to become your son. But that's as far as he gets. The father interrupts him. He already knows what the son's going to say, and he doesn't want to hear anything about the son becoming a slave. And so he interrupts him. He stops the speech, and here's what the father says. Quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet. Kill the calf we've been fattening. We must celebrate with a feast, for the son of mine was dead, and he's now returned to life. He was lost, now he's found. So the party began. And I love that phrase, so the party began. The father welcomes the son back around his table. And what exactly has the son done to deserve it? Get this absolutely clear in your mind this morning. And more importantly, in your heart. The son has done nothing to deserve this type of treatment. As it turns out, the father had nothing but good intentions in his heart and mind for his son. He didn't want his son to be clothed in shame, so he clothed him himself. He didn't want his son to feel like a slave, so he put a ring on his finger. He didn't want his son to feel like a slave, so he put sandals on his feet. The father did it all. The kid just stood there and received it. I wonder if the Apostle Paul wasn't thinking about this story Jesus told when he wrote these words in Romans chapter 5. When we were utterly helpless, Christ came at just the right time and died for us sinners. Now, most people would not be willing to die for an upright person, though someone might perhaps be willing to die for a person who is especially good. And here's these two great words. But God showed his great love for us by sending Christ to die for us while we were still sinners. While we were still a long way off. While we were still an absolute filthy mess. While we still smelled like pigs, he covered the distance for us. He showed up and he did for us what we could never have done for ourselves. Meanwhile, the older son was in the fields working. When he returned home, he heard music and dancing in the house, and he asked the servants, "What's going on?" "Your brother's back," he was told, "and your father has killed the fatted calf. We're celebrating because of a safe return." The older brother's mad. He doesn't even want to go in the house. He doesn't want anything to do with this party. He's outside cussing and kicking the rocks. I mean, he's so mad. And look what happens next. His father came out and begged him. This is the second time in the story that the father goes to a son and meets his son that he loves so much in his sinful, self-righteous mess. The father again covers the ground between him and his son that he loves. And this son has a speech for his father too. He's going to deliver it. The son replies, "All these years I've slaved for you and never once refused to do a single thing you told me to do." Now, doesn't that sound like an overstatement coming from a child? Never once? "And all that time, you never gave me even one goat for my feast with my friends. Yet when this son of yours comes back after squandering your money on prostitutes, you celebrate by killing the fatted calf?" I think there's two things the brother's saying here. "Don't you know what I've done for you? And don't you know what he's done to you? And here's the answer. Of course he does. Of course he knows. And thank God that what you and I do doesn't earn our way into or out of the Father's love. He knows. He knows what you've done to him. He knows what someone else has done to him. He knows it all. Back to David, Psalm 139. You made all the delicate inner parts of my body and knit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous, how well I know it. You watched me as I was being formed in the utter seclusion, as I was woven together in the ark of the womb. You saw me before I was born. Check this out. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed. He knows it all. This is Sister Madonna Buter, otherwise known as the Iron Nun. She's famous for competing in and completing triathlons. At the age of 82, she became the oldest person ever to complete the Ironman triathlon. In case you're wondering, that's 2.4 miles of swimming. I'd die in the first 10 meters. 112 miles of bike riding and 26.2 miles running. Let that sink in. Author and pastor Todd Bolswinger talks about a time when he was gathered at a meal the night before one of these triathlons, and all the competitors were gathered together, and they invited her to speak to the crowd, and this is what Sister Madonna Buter said. Tomorrow, when things get tough out there, remember you were loved into existence. If you get discouraged and want to quit, if you get injured and you can't finish it, if things don't go the way you hope, even though you have trained for this day for months or even years, even then, remember, you were loved into existence. Maybe one of the most important things about you is that you are completely known and you are completely loved by the Father, the Almighty, all-knowing God of this universe. The heart of the good Father is reflected in the remarkable ending of this really cool story when Jesus said, his Father said to him, "Look, dear son, you've always stayed by me, and everything I have is yours. We had to celebrate this happy day, for your brother," by the way, he's your brother, "was dead, and he's come back to life. He was lost, and now he's found. And that's why you've heard me say before today, a time or two before, Jesus did not come to make bad people good people. Jesus came to make dead people alive people." There's a gigantic and fundamental difference. I knew I wanted to preach on this idea back last fall about God and how we interact with him, but I really had no idea where I was going with it at the time. But I started collecting some sermon illustrations and looking up scriptures and writing down a few notes. And I remember writing down a sentence that I was so anxious to put in a sermon back then, and I forced myself to save it to now. But I thought of this. The space between your mess, your shame, your failures, your shortcoming, your regrets, the space between all that and the Father's table is occupied by the Father. The space between your mess, your failures, your sin, and God's table, that space is occupied by the Father. And he's not in an old blue rocking chair. He's on a throne. And that throne has a name. It's called the throne of grace. And you get to approach it, not because of you, not because of me, but you get to approach it with confidence because of what the author of Hebrews has announced. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may have mercy and find grace to help in times of need. In that famous story that Jesus told, the only thing more extravagant than the sin of the Son was the love and grace of the Father. He knows you better. He knows you better than you know yourself. He knows everything about you. He knows everything you've ever done. He knows everything you're ever going to do, and he still loves you. Everything you're doing, everything you will ever do, and he still loves you. So this week, born out of that reality, I want to leave you with a challenge. In fact, two challenges. Between now and next Sunday, I wonder if you would commit to doing these two things. Simple things. One, pray a simple prayer of invitation that you can pray with confidence because we no longer have anything to fear in our relationship with God because of his love and goodness. It's a prayer that you can find in the end of that Psalm 139. It goes like this. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Point out anything in me that offends you and lead me along the path of everlasting life. See, God knows you. And he does want to weed things out of your life. I read this article about modern counseling. It seems the new trend today is not to help people get their lives back on track or help them become better people, but to help them cope with not being a good person. In other words, if you're doing something and you know you shouldn't be doing it, the counselor's goal today is not to get you to change the behavior, but to change your attitude toward and just accept your sinfulness. But that's not what God wants in your life. He doesn't want you to make bad choices. He doesn't want you to accept your sinfulness. He wants to root it out. So ask God to search you and to show you and to help you. That's challenge number one. Challenge number two is to sing a song. Maybe for some that's a little uncomfortable because some don't like to sing. But I've heard you singing here. I see some of you singing in your car when you pull up. But sing this song. Sing it openly, sing it privately. Go way out back if you don't want anyone to hear you. But after you pray that prayer, thus sing this song. It's an easy one. It's a familiar one. It goes like this, and I invite you to sing it with me. God, you're so good. God, you're so good. God, you're so good. You're so good too.